After experiencing the transformative power of a regular meditation practice, it's natural to feel inspired to share this gift and guide others on their own journey of discovery through meditation. Join Buddhist teacher David Nichtern and Duncan Trussell, comedian and creator of the Netflix animated series The Midnight Gospel, for a free online event on Tuesday, May 7th at 6 p.m. Eastern Time. They'll discuss the profound practices of mindfulness in Dharma Moon's renowned mindfulness meditation teacher training program. Get certified by Dharma Moon to teach meditation, lead group practice sessions, and work with individual students. Visit dharmamoon.com/beherenow for more info and to reserve your spot for the free online event with David Nichtern and Duncan Trussell.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. With social gatherings picking up now that spring is here, it can be easy to ignore your social battery and spread yourself thin. So what's the right amount of socializing for you? Therapy can give you the self-awareness to build a social life that doesn't drain your battery. It's a great way to build relationship skills, figure out your goals, and so much more. If you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online and designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/BeHereNow today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/BeHereNow.
Welcome to Living with Reality, a podcast featuring archived teachings and modern conversations with Dr. Robert Svoboda, brought to you by the Be Here Now Network. Living with Reality explores Ayurveda and other wisdom traditions of India, which Dr. Svoboda has been studying for nearly 50 years. For more information, please visit BeHereNowNetwork.com/Dr. Svoboda. That's DRSVOBODA. Hello, and welcome to the inaugural episode of Living with Reality. I'm Paula Crossfield. I'm Dr. Svoboda's media manager, and I'll be helping to select some of the lectures and talks he's given over the years from our archives to share here with you. We really hope you enjoy this content. In addition, we'll be sharing original content as well, like today's interview, which I conducted with Dr. Svoboda back in December. It really goes into detail about how he came to India for the first time and learned about Ayurveda and the serendipitous circumstances that led him to the Ayurvedic College, in addition to his first meeting with the Aghori Vimalananda, his mentor. And he talks a little bit about some of the lessons he's learned and really carried into his life. We wanted to give you a sense of his background and who he is here in the first episode, since he's been studying these Indian sciences for almost 50 years. So we really hope you enjoy this. And just a few other things before we get started. Because of COVID-19, obviously, Dr. Svoboda has had to cancel a lot of his public talks, which is a shame. But out of that, we've developed a lot of online content, which has been helping a lot of people around the world in this crisis, and we wanted to continue that and make it really affordable. So we're now offering a subscription service that's going to give you access to some of the already recorded content, but also Dr. Svoboda is going to be doing a live lecture every month and a Q&A. So if you're interested in that, just go to drsvoboda.teachable.com, and that subscription service will be there and available through the month of May. We're going to have to close it after May because we're going to be focusing on our members. So if you really want to be involved, jump in. There's a bunch of different topics already scheduled for the upcoming 6 months, and we think you're going to love this content. And it's super affordable. It's around $1 a day. Another thing I wanted to tell you about is story time. So on May the 5th, Dr. Svoboda is going to be telling the story of Prahlada. So if you're interested in hearing more of his stories, which he's known for, this is a totally free offering. And we're going to be sending out more information about that in his newsletter, or you can find out on his social media. So go to drsvoboda.com, that's drsvoboda.com, for all the latest updates. Now for the interview. I hope you enjoy.
This is the first episode of your new podcast, so I thought that we should sit down and tell people a little bit about your background and also the topic. I mean, there will be a lot of archives that we have, you know, from talks that you've given over the years that we'll be putting up for people to listen to. But the concept that we've chosen to name this is living with reality. So maybe we could start there and you could talk about what living with reality actually means to you.
The genesis of that phrase lies with Vimalananda, my mentor. He was very fond of saying, and he said repeatedly, most of the time in English, because he could speak many languages, that it is always better to live with reality, because if you don't, you can be sure that reality will come to live with you. And that's something that, even from the first time that he said it, exerted a strong impression on me, because by the time I met him, I had already been living in India for almost a year and a half. And before that, I had been traveling in Africa and Asia and Europe for a year. And I had been exposed already to realities which were very different from the reality that I had grown up with in Texas, Louisiana, and Oklahoma. And in fact, my very concept of what reality meant and what was real and not real had already undergone some challenges. So his words, though, really struck a chord in my being. And I have been striving ever since to actually live with reality. And certainly, sometimes I've been able to do that more effectively and more accurately, and sometimes much less effectively, according to my own karmas and the blind spots that they produce. I am not pleased to have to say that at the advanced age of 66 and a half, that I am still having to learn for myself what reality is. But on the other hand, I'm glad that I can still be learning things at the advanced age of not that far away from 70. 3 score years and 10.
So can you talk a little bit, let's back up for a moment and talk about how you came to India as, you know, a person growing up in the 50s and 60s in Oklahoma and Texas and Louisiana. How did you find your way to India?
I was very fortunate in so many ways. And I was fortunate at sometimes in ways that I did not realize I was fortunate. And one way in which I was fortunate is that my father worked for an oil company and we moved from place to place. And my mother taught school, so it was easy enough for her to find work as well. And I was fortunate because I was able to experience a different realities, and certainly Texas, Louisiana, and Oklahoma are three different realities. I was very fortunate to arrive in Louisiana just when I was able to join the governor's program for gifted children, a summer enrichment program that I attended for 4 summers that had a tremendous effect on me. It was the first time I heard the name Sanskrit, for example. I was very fortunate. I went to a public high school in Tulsa, Oklahoma, Edison High School, which at that time was a very good high school. And, but I, while I was in high school, I started to become very unsatisfied with not necessarily with reality, but with what was being presented to me as reality. And, I read the Bhagavad Gita for the first time then, the old Edgerton translation, and I was exposed to some of the works of Sri Aurobindo that at that time were completely over my head. But I knew that there was something out there that I needed to be exposed to, but I didn't exactly know how to do that. So I decided to speed up my progress. I was always good at taking tests. I graduated from high school when I was 16. I was able to graduate from the University of Oklahoma at age 18 via various methods. And I didn't know what to do then. So several of my friends were going to medical school. So I decided to do that. I got admitted to medical school at the University of Oklahoma and decided that before I spent the next 10 years in a laboratory that I should go to experience something exotic. And the most exotic thing I could think of at that time in Tulsa, Oklahoma, was to go to Africa. So back at that time, of course, there was no internet, no mobile phones. You got things out of what we call books, including big, thick books that we called encyclopedias. And if you were lucky, you were able to, if people were writing books that were very unusual, you could still somehow find out about them. And I don't know how I found out about, there was a little booklet called, it was something like Across Africa Overland or something like that. It was a very thin book, and I wrote off for it. And I used that as my map to go across Africa overland. And it told you exactly what to do. Get down to Mauritania and take the iron ore train to Shum. And then there will be a truck and it will take you down to Senegal. And then you do this. And so I crossed overland. And that was a very much an eye-opening experience. And probably the most eye-opening experience was I got sick eating some tainted food, it tainted with parasites on the border between Mali and Ivory Coast, and ended up in Ivory Coast extremely unwell, and was extraordinarily fortunate to walk into a bookstore that was run by two young Frenchmen. And they said to me, "You look terrible." And I said to them, "I feel terrible." And they took me to their apartment where they were living, and they brought a young witch doctor to visit me. That's what they were calling him. And it transpires that they and he were going to a witch doctor's convention out in the bush that weekend. He was a very nice young Ivoirian. I forget what tribe he belonged to. But he came and looked at me, and all he did, and I watched him carefully, he got a glass of pure water and mumbled something over it and gave it to me. And I promptly went to sleep. And when I woke up, I was 90% better. And this was something completely unheard of to me. I couldn't believe that such a thing could happen. But having had it happen to me, I was mightily impressed. And I stayed there for another, I don't know, week or something to regain some of my energy, and read a copy of Autobiography of a Yogi for the first time. And that made me interested to some degree in India, but just it was more of a, as Vimalananda would put it, the coming event casting a shadow before it. I continued crossing overland with various vicissitudes, getting sick again in Nigeria and having a young Yoruba guy pick me up and take me home with him, and joining the Pokot tribe in Kenya as its first white member. And then, and interestingly enough, the woman who led the expedition that I attended to ethnographic expedition to meet the tribe and join it. At that time was, her name was Elizabeth Jean Brown. She now goes by Jean Sassoon. She got married afterwards. She lived in Africa for 25 years, in Spain for 25 years. And I met her. I've met her a few times since in Spain. She's now a little bit past 90, but still very much active, still publishing ethnographic, anthropological things about the Pokot and her work in Africa, still driving around in her town. So I'm very fortunate to have known her when she was much younger, and to have known her when she's now much less young. That was a very strong experience. I flew from Nairobi to England, and then I crossed overland to Nepal via Iran, which at that time was still being ruled by the Shah, and Pakistan and India. I really didn't like India the first time I went there. There were too many people. I got my belongings stolen on the border of India and Nepal, and I really didn't want to have to deal with India. I loved Nepal. We had family friends that were there. One of my high school and college buddies I've discovered serendipitously was there in the Peace Corps. So I had a great time there. Went to Everest Base Camp, went to the cheese factory in the Longtong Valley, and planned to continue remaining there until two things happened. One is I heard about Ayurveda from the Peace Corps doctor, Dr. Larry True. Excellent name for someone who is giving you good advice and is a doctor. And also I discovered that the Dalai Lama was giving a Kala Chakra initiation in Bodh Gaya in January. Now, I had no idea what Bodh Gaya was about, and I had no clue about what the Kala Chakra was about, but I had at least heard of the Dalai Lama. And everybody who was anybody in Kathmandu was going down to that. So I thought, well, everybody's going down there. I have to go there too. And so I went down there and I met some Ayurvedic doctors and I became more interested in Ayurveda. But even more to the point, and I had the darshan of the Dalai Lama and I had a strong experience at the Kala Chakra. But possibly the thing that affected me most at that event, Bodh Gaya is the place where Buddha attained enlightenment. Probably the strongest impression was made by a great Tibetan Lama named Dilgo Khyentse Rinpoche, who had done tremendous extreme penance for a long time. And I had no clue what he was. He was a very large man, so he was imposing by his height and his frame and size and so on. But also there was just something about him. There was a personal vibration, a sense of personal power, and not power that was being directed through his ego as an individual, just that he was acting as the channel for this power to express itself through him. I said to myself, I don't know what that is. I don't know where it came from, but I've got to try to experience that myself somehow.
So coming to India again, Did you have a sense that India was the place to find that?
After the Kala Chakra, I had the sense that India was the place to find that. Quite possibly, I could have found something similar in Nepal or somewhere else. But at that time, the very fact that this had happened in India made me think, no, India is the place I need to be for some time, so I can connect to whatever this yoga business is. And I didn't have any real clue as to how to proceed, but I did have a train ticket to go from Gaya, which is near Bodh Gaya, to Bombay. And so 36 hours later, I arrived in Bombay, and felt immediately at home, which I've always felt since in Bombay, and wandered around the city for probably 3 or 4 days until a train of events was set in motion that led to me entering the Ayurvedic College.
Can you tell us about that?
I was traveling with a friend of mine, also named Robert, we'd been sampling Bombay, and when right around dusk one day, we were in Colaba, outside a small Chinese restaurant, which doesn't exist anymore. This is 1974, January. And just at the moment that we walked up to the front door, a man and his wife and son came out of the restaurant. So I asked the man, "Is this a good restaurant, sir? Would you suggest that we eat here?" And the man immediately whipped out some money, handed it to us, said, "Why don't you eat here tonight and come and eat at our house tomorrow?" So I thought, sure, why not? And that's what we did. And I became very friendly with the family. His name was Mr. Praful Daftari. His wife's name was Kamla. And I would used to house sit for them when they went to the UK or the US. And there seemed to be some kind of connection, and even though I certainly had no clue, had more of a clue about the law of karma now, but not so much then, but even then it seemed significant that he was at that time the managing director of a brewery in Bombay that was brewing beer to the recipe of Tusker beer, which is the national beer of Kenya. So I thought, huh, Kenya, India, Bombay, there's a connection. And I was already thinking of taking the boat from Bombay to Mombasa and going back and living with the tribe for a while. But then I met the Daftaris, and they said, "What are you doing here in India?" And I said, "Well, I had been intending to go back to the U.S. and go to medical school, but when I was in Africa, I realized that there was more to medicine than what we think of as modern medicine. And now here in India, I'm very interested in yoga, and I've just learned about Ayurveda. So I would like to know more about Ayurveda." And they said, "Well, the only thing we know about Ayurveda is that," Mr. Daftari said, my maternal uncle, was the chairman of the committee that translated the Charaka Samhita, which is probably Ayurveda's most or best known text, translated it in the late 1940s into English, Hindi, and Gujarati. So I thought, well, there's definitely a connection there. And they said, and I met Dr. Mehta, he was a very nice man, but they said, "Other than that, we don't know anything, but if you will simply walk downstairs, one floor, right underneath us, is the flat of Dr. Punchi and Mrs. Punchi, And they have visiting with them a saintly man from Hyderabad. And he may be able to give you some advice. So I thought, what a great idea. So I walked downstairs and knocked on the door and explained that the Daftaris had sent me there to meet Mr. Krishnapuri Narayana Baba. So I met him and I said, I'm here in India and I was thinking I would like to study yoga and Ayurveda. And he said, what a great idea. And I said, I don't know how to go about it. So then he said, well, let's ask Mr. Fazilboy. And Mr. Fazilboy was an industrialist there. And despite being a Muslim, was very aligned with other spiritual paths as well. And Mr. Fazilboy, it transpires, happened to belong to the same Rotary Club chapter, Rotary Club Bombay South, that Pandit Shiv Sharma belonged to. And Pandit Shiv Sharma was the most eminent Ayurvedic Vaidya, Ayurvedic doctor, in India in that generation. In fact, so eminent that he was elected to Parliament twice, specifically for the purpose of regularizing Ayurvedic education in a legal framework in India. So I went to meet Pandit Shiv Sharma, and I said to him, Panditji, I would like very much to know if there is a way I can study Ayurveda in India. And he said, you're in luck, because it transpires that in Pune, which is not that far away from here, the Tilak Ayurved Mahavidyalaya is going to have a batch for the new Ayurvedic BAMS course that will be held in the medium of English. So yes, you will have to study Sanskrit and you'll have to pass 4 question papers in Sanskrit at the end of your 9 months of your first year, but at least you won't have to learn Sanskrit and Marathi at the same time. So I thought this is a big plus. And then the most critical aspect of this whole thing was he wrote out a letter saying that, dear Tilak Ayurved Mahavidyalaya, please admit this student into your course. And so I took that letter to Pune and I went into the Ayurvedic college, and very likely, I was certainly the first non-Indian to request enrollment there, and quite possibly I was the first Westerner ever to visit the college. And I went in and said, I've come here to enroll in your college. And just as they were collecting all the reasons why that would not happen, I presented my letter from Pandit Shiv Sharma, he who could not be refused. And with a certain amount of quiet grumbling, they set into motion the process by which I joined the college.
So it really seemed like it was meant to be, with all of these things falling into place.
There, from the moment that I met the Daftaris at that restaurant until I was enrolled in the college was, might have been as little as a week, probably was definitely not more than 10 days. So to have gone from having no clue what to do to being enrolled in an Ayurvedic college in 10 days definitely struck me as being noteworthy.
So can you talk a little bit about the first time you met Vimalananda and how you felt, or what struck you about him?
The reason I was trying to, that I met Vimalananda was that I had been fortunate before I left the U.S. and having a good summer job for 4 months, I was able to, that paid really well, I was able to save a lot of money. And fortunately at that time, it was not at all expensive to study at the Ayurvedic college, but I did need to get a couple of grants in order to facilitate my stay there during the entire 6 years of the course. And the first grant that I got was from the United States National Endowment for the Humanities. And it was to do some simple ethnography on what Ayurveda was and how it was being employed in the state of Maharashtra generally. Maharashtra is where both Bombay, or nowadays they call it Mumbai, and Pune are located, and with special focus on Pune. So I was meeting as many Ayurvedic doctors as I could, including the, of course, and one of the my most important informants in this context was Dr. Vasant Lad, who the college had assigned me to, since he had some facility with English, and since back at that time the college was assigning as much work as they could to Dr. Lad, who was had only recently joined the institution. And so I was various people were being suggested to me, and one day the Sanskrit professor who was looking out for me to people for me to interview told me about someone he had heard of who lived in Bombay but who regularly came to Pune during the racing season because he owned racehorses, but who was very knowledgeable in Ayurveda and Jyotish and Tantra and all sorts of Indian sciences. And so, and it transpired that whenever he was in Pune, he would stay with a family who lived a 20-minute walk away from where I was staying in the Ayurvedic, the hostel, the dormitory. And so I simply showed up there one day, and he wasn't there, but I found out when he was likely to be back, and then I went back again and explained to him who I was and what I was doing, and requested to give him a questionnaire that I had prepared and printed out, and with the hope that he would answer it for me, either in written form or when I returned verbally. And he said, "Why don't you just hold on to your questionnaire?" And then we started to talk, and over the next few days, he answered all of my questions without me asking them, which did impress me. And he said a couple of other things that impressed me even more. And then pretty soon, I was meeting him on a daily basis, and then pretty soon, we were doing many things together.
So did you get a sense that he had that thing, like you mentioned, Dilgo Khyentse Rinpoche having?
I did, but it was a different thing because, and at the time, of course, I had no clue about it, but it was not so evident on the surface. Dilgo Khyentse Rinpoche was, his job was to be as transparent as possible all the time. And Vimalananda, as I've discovered later, could be completely transparent to reality, but also made it a point not to, because he was much involved in the world, certainly more than Dilgo Khyentse Rinpoche, because he was so involved in the world, he, much of the time, appeared to be a simple worldly person, and did not always let people know what he was really up to, which he explained was the appropriate thing to do, especially when you're interacting with people who are worldly and really who have no value for spirituality, and for whom it would be inappropriate to speak about spiritual things because lack of openness to that would make that the very karma of speaking about it a karma that would have undesirable results.
I know it would be a lot to ask you to choose one thing that he taught you that really was the most important. But if you would talk about one thing that you really have taken throughout your life that you find to be something that you talk about a lot or that you use a lot in your day-to-day life that you learned from him.
Well, I would say it is, if I had to select one thing, and of course, living with reality could well be that one thing. But one aspect of living with reality is something that he suggested that he himself did and that I have been doing ever since. And that is in the morning, the first thing to do in the morning when you wake up is to be thankful for being alive and to be aware that you are absolutely going to die. It may be today, it may not be today, but that death is absolutely inevitable and to be prepared for it. And he also would pray, which is something that I do as well, to pray to reality, not to allow him to cheat his own conscience. So to always be open during the day to what was the right thing to do and to always try to do the right thing. And then at night, he would have three questions to ask himself, which are three questions I still ask myself. Have I lived? Have I really taken advantage of this day, which will never come back and brings me one day closer to the grave or the funeral pyre? Have I loved? As part of that living, have I really opened myself to the people around me in an open-hearted way? And have I laughed at my own limitations and at the ways that my own ego and my own personality structure has tried to interpose itself or manipulate the situation or interfere with that direct connection to reality? So I have found this, and this is a kind of niyama, a regular daily practice that is something that can, at the very least, assist a person to keep their attention focused on trying to live with reality.
And of course, a lot of the content that we'll have here on the podcast will go into a lot more detail about different stories that you have with Vimalananda and different learnings that you've had from him. And then, of course, your expertise in Ayurveda and other topics. But I just wanted to finish by getting you to talk a little bit about what you think Ayurveda brings to a modern world that we live in now.
There are many good things to be said about modern medicine, including particularly that it is of great use in a life-threatening crisis. Unfortunately, by virtue of it focusing on crises, it is not so useful in the context of trying to prevent the crisis from occurring. And that's what Ayurveda is really all about. It is a medical system, but more than that, it ayuhu vedaha. Veda means the knowledge of, and ayuhu means life. So it's the study of everything that has to do with embodied life, with life in a protoplasmic organism. And I think it is particularly critical nowadays that that we have seen the appearance of, and we are seeing an increasing interest in transhumanism, the concept that that the next stage in human evolution will be to export our personalities into machines. And for various reasons, I believe this will never be possible in actuality. But the very fact that people are interested in this and they're trying very hard to focus on it, instead of focusing on trying to find a healthier and more equitable way of living with the reality in which we have evolved. So many people nowadays believe that, oh, humans have simply ruined the planet and now we have to move to other planets and that's how the human race will survive. Again, I think that this is exactly the wrong direction to be focusing. I think it is critical that instead we focus on the ecosystem of living things and how we can return the human species into right alignment with all the other species with whom we have evolved and with whom we are sharing the planet.
Did you have anything else you wanted to say before we wrap up?
Only that Ayurveda, Jyotish, Vastu, all of these sciences are completely and utterly endless. So I have studied them for many decades, and the more that I learn, the more I discover just in fact how ignorant I am. So while I will be speaking about my own experience with various of these things, I would like to emphasize that this is my own experience. By no means do I claim to know everything or even a large fraction of everything. And as Vimalananda said repeatedly to me, do not take whatever I say as the gospel truth. Always try it out. See if it works for you. If it works for you, go ahead and do it and be serious about it and be genuine about doing it and get the result. If it doesn't work for you, throw it out and find something else new. Because he was always fond of saying that he did not believe in sampradaya. Sampradaya means a sect, like a religious or spiritual sect. He was not sectarian. He didn't believe in sampradaya. He believed in sampradaha, which means total incineration, burning down everything, all concepts, all mental obstructions, all limitations that keep you from the direct perception of reality. So not an easy thing to do, but something that is certainly worth attempting.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. With social gatherings picking up now that spring is here, it can be easy to ignore your social battery and spread yourself thin. So what's the right amount of socializing for you? Therapy can give you the self-awareness to build a social life that doesn't drain your battery. It's a great way to build relationship skills, figure out your goals, and so much more. If you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online and designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/beherenow today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.com/beherenow.